6 o'clock is the time. Keep it right here for City Visions.
Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Grace Wan. The months since George Floyd's murder have been filled with protests and calls for police reform, but less attention has been paid to an issue that affects the lives and livelihoods of Black people every day, racism in the workplace. In our second segment tonight, we'll hear stories about the various ways racism shows up at work and discuss possible solutions. And then we'll wrap up the hour with a conversation with the multi-talented Mia Pixley, the Bay Area musical artist and clinical psychologist. But first, it's been another sobering week in the fight against COVID-19. After months of staying at home and flattening the curve, California and the Bay Area find themselves on the front line of the pandemic. Getting timely results is challenging. The average age of COVID patients is now 41, and experts note that COVID victims often experience long-term effects from the virus. All Bay Area counties are seeing an increase in infections, and some, like Sonoma and Napa, are registering record-breaking numbers of hospitalizations. Without a coordinated federal response, are we doomed to continue along this path indefinitely? Is there any good news? Here to help us find the silver linings and make sense of everything else COVID-related, I'm pleased to welcome back Aaron Alday, health reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle, and Dr. Peter Chin Hong, infectious disease specialist at UCSF. Welcome back to City Visions, Aaron and Peter.
Thanks for having us. Hi, Peter.
Hey, Aaron.
Aaron, I want to start with you. Testing is the biggest topic these days. What is the state of testing? We've heard you can get a test, but the results, getting a results is a different matter. What's the average wait time?
The wait time has increased. I don't have at my fingertips what the average wait time is, and I think it varies quite a bit from county to county and place to place, but definitely people are in places waiting 7 to 10 days. A week is not remotely unheard of. It may be getting close to the average being a week. And also, frankly, in some places, people are waiting just to get a test. We have loads of anecdotal reports of people not being able to get tested in their area for a week or two, not being able to schedule anything for a week or two out. I will say that the latest thing is the state last week created sort of a tiered system of prioritization for testing. So, with certain people kind of most at risk, I think those in the hospital are sort of the first priority to get tested. And then it kind of goes down the ranks of people who are, a known exposure, people who have symptoms, people who are essential workers, and so on and so forth. And just today, notably, the state said that people should not expect on-demand testing. So if you're just a regular person who wants to know, it's not appropriate to be getting tested at this time.
Peter, if you can't get tested, and certainly if you can't get test results, what's the point of how are we going to control the pandemic if testing is so difficult to get and results are hard to find?
Exactly. First, let me just amplify what Aaron said too. And one of my colleagues called it theatrics. If you can't get a test in a timely fashion, because what's the point of waiting 2 or 3 weeks? You would have already gotten the symptoms, and it defeats the whole purpose of the test, which, to get to your question, Grace, it's the anchor of the triad of test, contact, and isolate. So if you don't have the test part of the triangle, how can you control the pandemic? Exactly what you said.
Well, Aaron, we've been in this for several months now. Why is testing so hard to get? Why has the state not been able to get more tests and get more labs online?
That is the difficult question. It's kind of plays into this federal response from day one. I mean, testing has been our problem all along. And frankly, it's really frustrating for a lot of people because we're back at exactly the same problems we had back in March and April, which is they're running out of the chemicals used to conduct the tests in the lab. They're running out of the swabs, you name it, and they're running low on it, which is, like I said, it's exactly where we were a few months ago. And people are really frustrated that why have we let this happen again? And we don't have clear answers as to why we've let this happen again.
Well, Aaron, you highlighted it. There's no federal response, and every state, frankly, almost every county seems to be doing its own thing here. When the response is so hyper-localized, does that mean we're going to be experiencing spikes in infections and just keep on going until we have a vaccine? Peter?
Yeah, so basically, there's going to be circulating virus continuously. In fact, probably the only place where there's going to be herd immunity is San Quentin Prison, just because so many people are infected. So it actually becomes a good model of herd immunity. But for everybody else, there's going to be enough circulating virus where, as we put out the embers, to take somebody else's words, in one part of the country, then another part of the country goes up. And then we go into the cycle over and over again until we have the vaccine. So it becomes very frustrating. And like Aaron said, it's like, you know, Back to the Future, except there's no, you know, good parts of Back to the Future.
Yeah, no Michael J. Fox parts. Aaron, you had a story in today's Chronicle comparing California and New York. What did that comparison tell you? And are there any lessons that we can learn?
I think there are some good lessons that we can learn from that. One of the things, you know, I think most people are familiar with sort of the differences. People who've been paying attention are familiar with the differences in how, in our initial response to this, and the fact that California did that really early and aggressive shelter in place and really remarkably, notably kept our cases down. New York came in just a little bit too late, and we saw what happened. It just spiraled out of control so fast. I mean, just within like a week or two, they were just completely overrun with cases, and we saw how that turned out. And what we see in New York, though, is that they really tightened down, just as California did. They saw that have a even more dramatic effect, frankly, on their cases, because they saw this sharp downfall. If you look at their curve of cases, it goes from this huge peak to very low levels in just a matter of weeks. But what they did that's key, that maybe, you know, some folks are saying we can learn, take a lesson from here in California, is they kept their shelter in place a long time after reaching that peak. So they really let those numbers get down low and then stayed sheltering for a long period of that low transmission. And the hope is that they did it for long enough and they got transmission to low enough levels that they can now kind of learn from us and the mistakes we made in reopening too fast and take a more kind of gradual approach. Maybe be more thoughtful about it, you know, really push that masking message right from the get-go, really talking a lot about keeping things outdoors, not doing indoor events, you know, not having these social gatherings. So while we were sort of opening up and seeing our cases surge, they were keeping an eye on us and presumably getting some lessons from us. And, you know, their cases are staying. They've stayed very, very low for a pretty long period of time now, for, you know, a month or two, which is pretty remarkable given where they were back in April.
Peter, what are you learning from your medical colleagues on the East Coast, particularly New York, about how they're treating coronavirus today?
Well, I think, like Aaron was saying, there's not as many people in the hospitals anymore. There are still people getting sick and being admitted. But, you know, like what we were like, they essentially have hospital resources in step with demand, which I think ultimately is the most important thing. So even though we might have a higher plateau, as people say in California right now, we're still not exceeding hospital capacity. And I think that is the silver lining. We're never going to be a tri-state New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, because we wouldn't have to take care of patients in the hallway or in another room that wasn't meant to be an IC room. And we're still, you know, we're close, but I think with Governor Newsom's, you know, restrictions a couple of weeks ago, I think it will, you know, take some time to show effect. But so far, we're kind of living that realization.
Well, I think we're seeing that these social gatherings that people are having, it's summertime, people want to see their friends, there's a little bit of shelter-in-place fatigue. That might be changing the way the results are coming in. I was interested in the story that the Chronicle ran over the weekend about a wedding that happened in July, and one of the cathedrals off of Washington Square. 100 people came to a wedding. The bride and groom now have coronavirus. A couple of attendants do as well. And the guests came from all over the country, Nashville, Southern California, and the like. And I'm curious about how you all are seeing or thinking about people going off to summer vacation and then coming back to their hometowns. Are you worried that, Peter Chin-Hung, about more increased cases because people have been traveling?
Yeah, so I think the biggest demonstration of how to deal with that on a institutional level is what we've been doing with students. So students coming back to the health profession schools from all over the country now, it's the season for this year to start, they're being tested. And not only that, because testing just takes care of a snapshot, people are going to be randomly tested during the year to kind of, again, you know, define the environment. So one can, you know, there are different ways to think about people who go away and then come back. Certainly a responsible thing to do would be to, if they were in risky situations, to at least define where they are virologically speaking, particularly if they're coming back to a household with elderly parents or somebody who's ill. And then you kind of, at least you'll have that starting point. Other people do easier things like isolate, you know, if you're coming back from a high risk situation. But so there are different ways to think about it.
Well, another hot topic in COVID is schools. Last week, Governor Newsom announced that schools would largely be online if you're in a county that's on the watch list, which is most of the Bay Area except San Mateo. I think a silver lining or something that kept people's anxiety low about COVID was that it seemed to spare children of the worst of its effects. Yet out of Texas, we're hearing stories about children getting sick, infants dying. Peter Chin Hong, do we know anything about how COVID affects kids? And is it different than what we knew at the beginning?
Yeah. So in the beginning, I think we thought that kids were very protected. There was an early study from Iceland where they basically sampled everyone in the population. Of course, it's a more homogeneous population with better access to healthcare. But nevertheless, they showed that under 10 years old, there's pretty much no virus detected by, you know, PCR or looking for viral fragments. Then we got reports from Switzerland and Australia and some other places where when they reopened schools, the kids seemed to do okay. But those were times in, you know, I think in Switzerland, maybe less Switzerland, more Australia, where there wasn't a lot of virus in the community. So I think at the bottom line, it depends on that. But recently, like last week, we got the best study yet, which was a study from South Korea, looking at more than 65,000 people. And they looked at the people who had COVID, including kids like the ones you mentioned in Texas. And they went to the households and then swabbed everyone in the household. So the question was, if the kid had COVID, how many adults got it? And it was very interesting because if you were 10 and under, 5% of those groups got it from the kid. And if you were 10 to 19, they acted like adults. So about 20% of those households got COVID from that infection if the kid was above 10. So that might give us some guidance about schools. So if the community rate is low, then you might be able to take that risk. If the community rate is super high, then you kind of have to judge where your values are.
Another reason why you might want to stay away from your tweens and teens during the crisis.
Yet another reason, believe me.
Another reason. Aaron, I wanted to ask you, what's the next? We've been talking a lot about, this is the first wave, or no, this is the second wave. Did the state officials or local officials have a definition of what wave we're in, and what's the plan going forward?
I think most people think we're still in the first wave here. I mean, certainly in California, we never got out. We never climbed our way out of the first wave. I don't think the United States really ever climbed out of the first wave. I think increasingly we're thinking that the end, hopefully, of the first wave will, you know, be the end of summer, early fall, but then we'll be having to not, I know you want silver linings, but the truth is then we're going to be bracing for flu season and what that brings. And I know there's a lot of concern. There's a lot of preparation already happening with that in mind.
Do you recommend that people make an extra effort this season, Peter Chin Hong, to get their flu vaccine?
Totally. And that is a silver lining, Grace. I would turn Aaron's comment again into a silver lining, which is we do have drugs for influenza, which is Tamiflu. We do have a vaccine for influenza, and I think it's more important than ever for people to go and get their vaccine, you know, in time, anticipate, at least you can take something else out of the equation, at least reduce the risk substantially.
And Aaron, what should we be looking for in the weeks ahead? We always like to ask you, you're our prognosticator.
She's a soothsayer.
She's our soothsayer.
I am not soothsaying anything. All I will say is it's, you know, kind of the same old, which is we just... You know, right now we definitely will want to keep an eye on the case counts as per usual and see just if things are steady now. But really look at those hospital numbers. I think everybody wants to see those start to creep down because those case counts are so reliant on this testing situation, which is just such chaos. But the hospital numbers are pretty reliable. Those mean something. When you see those go up or go down, that is a really, you know, good or bad sign of what type of transmission is happening in the community. So I think for all of us to kind of feel like we're getting ahead of this thing, we really want to see those hospital numbers start to get down.
Peter Chin Hong, any last words?
I think we're going to pull out of this in California. I don't think we're going to exceed capacity. I think people are buckling down. We've done it before and we'll do it again.
And with that, thank you so much again for joining us, Aaron and Peter. Aaron Alday is a health reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle, and Dr. Peter Chin Hong is an infectious disease specialist at UCSF. Thanks again.
Thank you, everyone.
Thanks, guys.
Next up, we're talking about racism in the workplace. Black Lives demonstrations have galvanized the country to address systemic racism. But will those calls for reform extend to the workplace? Following George Floyd's murder, companies were quick to make statements in solidarity with the protest movement. But as protests continued on the streets, more and more employees began pointing out the racism within their own organizations. In Silicon Valley, Cisco fired a group of employees for comments posted during an online diversity forum, including remarks that, quote, Black lives don't matter, all lives matter, end quote. Here in San Francisco, SF MoMA found itself embroiled in controversy after it deleted a critical comment on Instagram by a former employee who alleged that the museum fostered a culture of racism. Within a month, a senior curator and another high-level employee had resigned. In media, technology, academia, and beyond, a reckoning is taking place about what it means to be Black at work. But are companies' claims of solidarity merely performative? Will businesses focused on the bottom line and now facing a COVID economy really work to care about diversity? And what does it mean to have a truly inclusive workplace, and what will it take to get there? Joining me tonight for this conversation and to discuss these questions and more are Dr. Laura Morgan-Roberts, professor of practice at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business. Dr. Roberts has published over 50 research articles and edited 3 books, including Race, Work, and Leadership, New Perspectives on the Black Experience. Welcome, Laura.
Thank you, Grace.
And we also have Precious Stroud. She's the founder of the Black Female Project, an Oakland-based organization devoted to supporting, telling the stories of, and empowering Black women facing structural racism and sexism in the workplace. Welcome, Precious.
Thank you, Grace.
Well, I'm pleased to have you both. And as always, we invite you, our listeners, to join the conversation. To ask questions or share your stories about racism in the workplace, give us a call at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or send an email to cityvisions@kalw.org. Or find us on Twitter. We're at cityvisionskalw. Laura, I wanted to start with you. Your work is deeply rooted in data, and I'd like to talk about the snapshot of how racism affects Black workers in the workplace. I think many people think, oh, we were in a post-Obama racially enlightened state, and now in the last 4 years we're seeing, well, maybe not so much. So can you tell us about how the data, what the data shows about Blacks in the workplace? In terms of leadership and numbers?
Well, we find that Black people are still disproportionately represented at the lowest levels of occupational hierarchies. So it's often a bit of a foil when we say we need to have more diversity in the workplace. We have diversity in the workplace. You know, in many of the hospitals that you were just referencing in the COVID segment, we know that over 50% of the frontline caregivers are women of color, but less than 3% of all physicians are Black Americans. And that number has not changed since the mid-20th century. In fact, today, there are fewer Black men graduating from medical school than there were in the late 1970s. So in terms of representation, when we look at the more senior levels at various professions, medicine being one, we can talk about tech. Just representation in tech in general at firms like Google and Microsoft and Apple, we're talking about 3 to 6% of Black professionals in their workforce, when Black people represent 13% of the U.S. population. But again, an overrepresentation at the lowest levels of organizations. So all of this then points to a broader question about the systemic racism that continues to fuel these representation dynamics. And so I think it's important for us to acknowledge that racism was designed and orchestrated to prevent the advancement of Black people. These ongoing intergenerational gaps in wealth, educational access, fair housing, medical treatment, and occupational representation all continue to limit social mobility and career advancement. So we found that in our research as a consistent struggle and a set of obstacles, structural obstacles that Black people face in their career journeys.
And Precious Stroud, your organization sort of amplifies the voices of Black women in the workplace. Are you finding similar stories that to what Dr. Roberts is talking about?
Absolutely. Absolutely. From 6 years ago when we started to today, the thing that helps is that research helps people put their personal and collective experiences into context. But when you're navigating and you are not aware of how systemic issues play out in the workplace, things are personalized. You think it's all about you and that people are attacking you and somehow you're not good enough. And you begin to internalize all of those experiences. And now I'm reaching for something that really I can't attain because actually there are barriers in place or there's obstacles in place or simply because you haven't been exposed to people who look like me, who are leaders, you haven't promoted, so you don't see people like me. So therefore, in your head, I am not the next one to be promoted. You might like me a lot, but don't trust that they may not trust me with the finances and otherwise. So yes, we absolutely see it playing out personally. But again, that context is so critical and appreciate all the research.
Well, I think that data is really striking. And some of the statistics that you were reeling off, Laura, including the low numbers of Blacks and Latinx people in tech, which is big here in the Bay Area. I mean, at Facebook, 3% of its work population was Black and only 4% Latinx. Apple is 12% Black, 9% Latinx. And Google, which has 98,000 worldwide employees, has 2% Black employees and 3% Latinx. These are all companies that say that they care about the issue of diversity at the workplace. What's going wrong here, Laura?
Well, I think I could speak to our data about what's going on as reflected in a series of studies that we compiled in our latest volume, Race, Work, and Leadership. And we found that at various stages of one's career, Black and brown people face a unique set of challenges and obstacles. At the entry levels of their career, imagine that you are like going out for a wonderful day by the pool, and you're not the strongest swimmer. Nobody is the strongest swimmer, but some people are like walked into the shallow end, given some floaties. You know, they've got a lot of support to help them navigate until they build up their confidence, where other people, in this case, Black and Latinx people, feel that they're thrown straight into the deep end. And it's a sink or swim situation from day one. But as they're trying to swim or navigate these waters, they're trying to also give off the impression that they've got it all under control. So they're sitting here, you know, paddling like heck, not really understanding how to navigate the deep waters of organizations that are so burdened with systemic racism, like many that you mentioned and so many others. They don't have the sponsorship or the support to help them navigate. And then they feel that it's too dangerous or risky for them to make themselves vulnerable, to let other people know that they're struggling and they need help, because they're afraid that that would reinforce some negative stereotypes that other people have about their competence. See, I knew you didn't belong here anyway. So they talk about feeling like they can't be authentic at work. They can't truly be themselves. They can't express their emotions. That also means that they can't truly express their needs. They talk about feeling like they don't have the access to the role models, the mentors, the sponsors that would help them to advance. And then here's the catch. Once they finally learn how to navigate the waters, they feel like they're not recognized for that skill set and the strength that they've developed. So they have their authority continually challenged or questioned. Their legitimacy and credibility is questioned. They're always trying to fight against a set of assumptions or stereotypes that say, you don't belong here, or if you do belong here, you're not supposed to have the amount of power or authority that you have within this system. And all of that does create attacks. It takes a toll psychologically, mentally. It's costly for the organization because the organization is losing out in droves on the ways in which people of all backgrounds can contribute maximally from a position of strength. And when you've got one segment of your organization who, you know, feels like they don't have the freedom to be, much less the freedom to lead.
Well, we're on a Zoom call and we're looking at each other on Zoom, and I see Precious nodding her head, you know, to everything that you're saying, Laura. And I wonder, Precious, in your organization and with the women that you work with and our colleagues with, is this something that they've been saying to you?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, what I really appreciated was this kind of two-sided position of this. You have the harm that's caused, and then you have the health implication. So imagine over and over again, you're going in, and a lot of women we met at the point where they were trying to regain some of their wellness and or trying to just like, am I crazy? Like, what is happening? What is happening? Because I'm not being, there's something going on that it's not true. It's not real. Did they really just say that? Yeah, they really just said that, and everyone thought it was okay. And the fact that you were offended is actually a red flag to everyone that there's something wrong with you. And you get around your peers. Go ahead, Grace.
No, go. Keep going.
Oh, so then you get around your peers and everyone's affirming you and you're like, oh, okay, I get it. Oh, okay. And then the other thing I thought about as Dr. Roberts was talking was around the, you do work hard, and we meet lots of women who are very accomplished, and they can talk about the triumphs, but when we would say, so what are your stories about navigating racism and sexism in the workplace? And they'd be like, oh, you know, I don't really have any stories, you know, and give them a couple weeks. Then it's like all of this, because you had to just get through it. So they never stopped that burden, the pain. And that's when you start seeing the autoimmune diseases. You start realizing people look back and say, well, wait, who am I today? Because I started to self-isolate because I was working so hard. I was isolated at work because of the social conditions and just the societal way that people segregate toward people who look like them. And all of that plays out and it takes a psychological toll, like you were saying. And then also, you know, migraines, all of these things that we hear related to stress.
Well, I would imagine too, in certain types of workplaces, when the numbers of Black and Latinx workers are so low, that there are not a lot of allies or colleagues to talk to kind of reinforce that experience. So that makes organizations like yours, Precious, even more, can I say, precious to people as a resource, so that you could kind of make sure that you're not being gaslit by your employers. But I feel like we're seeing a lot of people come out on social media talking about their businesses. I think in part because many corporations have come out to the forefront to say Black Lives Matter, and employees, ex-employees are saying, well, that seems very performative because let me tell you what it's really like to work in this environment. And I'm curious why you both think that people have, one, looked to social media to air those grievances, and two, why now? And I'll start with you, Laura.
Yeah, I think that this moment has been fueled by the heavy reliance we have right now on social media to stay connected, knowing that given the pandemic, we don't have many of the other outlets that we would have had otherwise to be connected. So the role and the presence of social media in our society right now is amplified. There's also research that shows that Black people are most likely to use social media for their authentic expressions. So all of that experience, that narrative, that storytelling, the artistic freedom and expression that they don't have in their educational environments or in their work environments, they're able to co-create a community in social media where they can be heard and they can be affirmed. And so we just had this meeting of the moments in which the channel was already in place. This is a way in which Black people express themselves, particularly millennials, right? And we know that they're some of the loudest voices who are calling companies around their integrity and saying, if you want to jump in this social media channel with us, by all means, come on. But this is a place where we critically question one another. This is not a place where you just come out and issue a unilateral, you know, statement that's all about window dressing. If you're entering into this space, you're going to hear our voices in response to what you say. So, you know, it's a moment where leaders are having to stretch and grow in ways that they haven't before because they've not had to listen to stakeholders as much as they've listened in the past 2 months. And bottom line, I think it's a healthy discourse in most circumstances. But I would love to hear what Precious has to say about this too.
Precious?
Well, because of this, I'd say, practiced compartmentalization that people go, like I go to work and I'm this part of myself and I go home and I'm that part of myself. What this allows is, given what has transpired and just the rate of, I'm so tired of trying to make you comfortable that I'm Black and I'm Black all day and I'm Black whether you know I'm Black or not. And so can you see me fully? And in this place where I'm actually able to connect with people who respect me, all kinds of people who respect and love me for who I am, this is going to be the truth. And that truth is the thing that's a form of kind of liberated, it liberates one's thinking, and then you can actually navigate with some clarity. So that's what comes to mind for me about this. There's a level of a part of freedom. And whereas in those spaces that can be so, like you feel, you literally feel like you can't say anything, this time has certainly given people an opportunity to say, even if it costs my job, that's not worth enough for me not to say something today.
Well, I want to get back to that point, but this is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco. We're talking about racism in the workplace. Have you experienced racism at your place of work? And what do you think would lead to a more inclusive workplace? You can join our program by calling 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can email us at cityvisions@kalw.org. We're also on Twitter at cityvisionsKALW. Precious, you were talking about that this moment was a time when people might be feeling more courage and power to speak about not just even blatant racism, but microaggressions. And mm-hmm. I was curious about that because right now, you know, we are in a COVID economy. People might be afraid of their jobs. And do you have some advice about how people can handle microaggressions and aggressions at work and raising them? Because the trope is often somebody will say something, it's kind of, or is racist. And people, when they're called on it, will say, I was just joking. You can't take a joke, or that's not what I meant. How can we help people handle that and confront that?
So, I mean, I think the first thing is people have to understand how systemic racism shows up within their workplace. And also they have to understand what their level of risk is going to be. So I don't have like a prescriptive, this is what we all do, or this is what we've learned. What we know is when we started collecting stories, the word white supremacy wasn't being said on the news every night, right? Mm-hmm. So the whole conversation has shifted. And if there are allies within that organization who are either your employee resource group or other places that are organizing around the state of the culture of the organization, go there. There's no need to stand out. Well, everyone is on, they make their decision for themselves. I have had women tell me in the last 4 weeks, I'm the only Black person there. Most of the people there don't even know anybody else Black. They're coming to me for everything. Yes, it's exhausting. This is a really great opportunity for me, this position, and I really want to leverage this role for my professional moving forward. And I've had people say, the opposite. So that's what I'm hearing.
Yeah. And you're mentioning how in the workplace, people are feeling both a opportunity to talk about their experiences, but also a burden for having to be the cultural ambassadors. So it is for their companies, and maybe not getting the recognition that they deserve for that work. And you talk about that, Laura, in ways that companies and corporations can address some of the systemic racism is to recognize the burden on Black employees who are tasked with educating their colleagues.
Yes. And the burden manifests in terms of time and energy. And often the time and energy is working in service of a larger cause. And people generally don't take issue with expending their time and energy in a way that helps them to work in service of a larger cause. If it's something that they're powerful, I mean, that's a powerful draw for them, they can be truly motivated to, you know, to contribute in that direction. The educating piece comes with having to educate while also validate the experience of the dominant group. And in this case, we're often talking about white people who have had power and have had the privilege of not really having to think about race and think about inequality and think about code switching and, you know, cultural taxes and all of these dynamics that we're talking about today. They've just sort of been able to move through their space and tune out. So understandably, it is jarring for them to now start to, you know, really take in what it means to live and exist and perpetuate this kind of inequality within the workplace. Racism's not just out there in the streets. Yes, it's right here in our organization as well. But the burden, again, comes in for Black and brown people who then have to educate while validating. So trying to hold this psychologically safe space to continue to say, I know you're okay. I know you're a good person. I know you just meant it as a joke. I'm sure you didn't mean that the way that it came out. It's okay. I understand that you feel badly about it. That's where the other layers come in, because what happens is the person who has been bearing the harm of racism and the injury of racism for so many years now has a moment to make that visible, but in an instant it pivots so that the responsibility of the Black or brown person is to comfort those who were in the majority group who perpetuate a lot of the inequality, so to speak.
They don't
mind being experts. And if they're going to be valued for their expertise, you know, this is going to show up in my performance evaluation. And you're going to say, now I know you're truly a team player and we appreciate everything you did. You know, there are a lot of individuals who would welcome that kind of acknowledgement and recognition. But the emotional labor goes unrewarded.
Yeah, it's that emotional labor we were talking about. And another aspect that I think has been interesting is this idea in hiring of cultural fit. A lot of companies say, well, we're looking for a cultural fit here. And that seems kind of benign. Of course, you want people who will have a common goal to your corporation or your business. So you just want a cultural fit. How is that not such a great way to think about hiring, Laura?
Well, the problem with cultural fit is that we over-select on people who remind us of ourselves. So that means that we're not going to bring in the diversity of backgrounds and perspectives that we need in order to be agile, be innovative, be responsive to the market. It also means, though, that we're going to over-select on people who won't critically question what we do and how and why we do it. And so when it comes to these moral issues or values-based issues around justice and fairness and equality, you know, someone who gives a signal that they might speak up about those issues is going to be less likely to be hired, you know, or promoted on the basis of cultural fit. I'm just not sure they could really, you know, fit in and get along with the senior members of our team here in the organization.
Right. And
but it's not competency based, right? It's entirely subjective, and it is a biased criterion, as you were mentioning. And so everybody loses in that scenario.
And it seems like companies have for a long time had created diversity and inclusion officers, or some of them at their workplaces, to kind of smooth over some of the things that we've been talking about. How have they been successful and how have they not been successful, Precious, in your experience?
Well, I will have to lead with how they haven't been successful, based on the fact that we have people asking us for support all the time. And I'm sure some people are doing it really great. It's just, I don't hear about those people. Mm-hmm. So we know that when you have a figurehead with no staff and no budget, that's not very effective. We know that when you're a Black ERG and you have no budget, you're ineffective. We know if you're not talking to HR and you're not changing HR practices and you have no power at the table and no presence in any C-suite conversation, then you don't have any power to actually shift culture and make change. There are people who are doing great work. I don't hear a lot about that.
And Laura, what about you? What are the shortcomings and what are the wins when a company has a diversity and inclusion office or officer?
I think a lot at this current moment, a lot of diversity and inclusion officers are acknowledging that while they've made great strides in some areas of diversity and inclusion, they have not made great strides where race is concerned. And many would openly admit that they have not touched race. While they have worked diligently on some other issues around gender, sexual orientation, ability or disability status, and some universalistic principles around belongingness and widespread acknowledgement about unconscious bias. Kind of like we've all got it. You know, we all want to belong. We all have our biases. And that conversation is helpful in some respects, but it does not address the structural inequality that is associated with racism and white supremacy. For the past 30 years, firms have become, all organizations, not just firms, schools, nonprofits, have all become more and more hesitant to even name race as part of their DEI agenda. Because they've tried to figure out how they could hold on to a piece of their DEI agenda after the affirmative action rollbacks occurred in the past 20 years. They had to reinvent and repackage and rebrand their programming and initiatives so that they didn't signal race-based and then sort of put them on the radar. And in so doing, the pendulum swung so far in the opposite direction that 2 months ago, you would not have been able to stand up in a DEI training, as Precious said before, and say something about white supremacy. That would not have gone over very well at all. So we're in a very different space right now than we have been over the past few decades in this work. Well, DEI professionals have been successful in some ways. But right. Well, not here. Yeah.
Well, how do we capture this moment? I mean, we have momentum. People are talking about white supremacy. The word systemic racism has probably reached the tops of everyone's Twitter feeds in a way in the last 5 months, and it never has. So how do we keep going on this to make sure that there really is a systemic change in response to systemic racism? And Precious, I'll start with you.
Mm. Well, certainly we need to educate ourselves about Black people. So you need to see me beyond the stereotype or the caricature that you believe I am, right? I don't look at Charlie Sheen and assume, oh, well, all white men must be like that, right? We know there's a nice broad spectrum of people. Same is true for Black women. And I'm human first. And I think that would go a long way. As far as the systems change, I'll leave that to Dr. Roberts to address, but I do think there is something about personal accountability and awareness and education that's really important.
And Laura, you've talked about the moral case for addressing this issue. Can you talk about that a little bit and what things that we can do to capture the momentum of the moment?
Yeah, so I think the moral case is what has brought us to this moment. We've been touting almost exclusively the business case for diversity for a few decades and trying to gain momentum and motivate some of the decisions that have been made in the past 6 weeks. And the business case was just not compelling enough for many people to, you know, abandon some of their sacred traditions, symbols, brands, you know, or just fundamental belief that the status quo was acceptable. It was moral outrage that catapulted people into this deeper level of consciousness right now. And that moral outrage about the injustice and the harm of what's been done and what continues to happen is what's going to drive the kinds of decisions that need to be made for systemic change. Those decisions require a new focus on equity. And equity means that you triage, you identify the individuals and the constituents within the system who have the greatest need. And then you allocate the resources necessary to address those longstanding and deep-seated needs that they have. This counters our meritocratic ideals about how things happen in organizations, but those are the kinds of structural decisions that have to be made in order for us to truly undermine and dismantle the systemic racism that continues to persist. I mean, some of the things we can do along the way are targeted hiring, support, development, sponsorship, you know, promotions, all of those programs. But I think the underlying principle here is equity.
Well, and I think it's a sustained effort too, right? It's not just, it's going to be hard. It's Absolutely. Not going to be easy work, and Absolutely. You need to really be committed to it. And I was just thinking about how Dr. King said that sometimes the United States feels like a 10-day nation, goes from crisis to crisis, you know, every 10 days, it's a new thing. And for corporations to really attack this, it seems like they're going to have to put some real, put their shoulders into it. But there are some, I mean, reading your work, there are some corporations or companies that are doing good work, tying diversity to their CEO compensation, like at Microsoft and even at Google. But one thing is that most of America is comprised of small businesses, not Fortune 500s and large corporations. So if you're in a smaller workplace that may not have an HR department, how can you navigate it? What kind of advice can you give a person starting out in their career or even mid-level through their career precious about how to navigate these tough issues?
Well, the first thing is to understand who you are, where you feel comfortable, what kinds of work environments where you can thrive, what battles you want to fight and what battles you don't want to fight. Identify people who you can have authentic conversations with, but most importantly, maintain your own well-being, health, and wellness. That's the top of the list. And if you're in a work environment that doesn't do that, then there's a choice to be made.
And Laura, I like this idea of a moral case, but how do you convince a company that is facing like a pandemic economy to make the moral case for putting not just the time, but the money into making diversity, not just diversity, but inclusion and retention an important aspect of their work?
We have to help people connect to their personal sense of why or their purpose. We have to help people to build authentic relationships across difference. So this isn't just a political issue or an agenda, but it's about having a deep level of investment and concern in supporting people who are in my organization, in my profession, in my industry, live in my community, or what have you. And that can translate from the largest corporation to the small business owner when you think of it in the realm of trying to build and sustain these relationships. But I think, you know, having that clarity of purpose is important. But the last piece is you've got to count the cost of systemic racism. So I think going forward, we need to be more transparent about the harm and the damage and the cost that all organizations are incurring by turning a blind eye toward racism or allowing it to perpetuate. And then if people aren't motivated by gain, we know they sure as heck are motivated by loss. And right now they obviously can't afford to do that.
Well, wise words from our panel, and we'll have to leave it there. I'd like to thank you for joining us tonight, Dr. Laura Morgan Roberts and Precious Stroud, for a fascinating conversation about racism in the workplace. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yes. Thank you. Stay with us. Coming up, we're going to be joined by Bay Area artist and clinical psychologist Mia Pixley. Here she is performing her piece, Witching Hour, under the alias Bialu.
Witching Hour. What flies in light shuffles below. Witching hour. What grows in light now hangs limp and low. Here is where what's come.
Mia Pixley is with us tonight. She's a professional cellist, she's a singer, a composer, and she's also a practicing clinical psychologist. And her latest EP is Inside Under, which you can find on her website, miapixley.com. Mia Pixley, welcome to City Visions.
Hi, Grace. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's so nice to have you. And I love that piece, Witching Hour, which on your website, I think the parentheses is 3 a.m. and anxiety, which I think is pretty appropriate for the times that we're living in right now. Your music doesn't fit easily into one genre. How would you describe it and what are your influences?
Yeah, I get asked this sometimes. I've tried Baroque pop, but there's blues in there. Maybe I should just call it jazz, but experimental classical. So yeah, folk.
Well, and how did you get into the cello? Where did that all start for you?
Yeah. So I grew up in Austin, the University of Texas String Project, has this great affordable string project for youth. And when I was four, my sister, who was 2 years older, came home with a violin. And I was like, okay, where's my instrument? And so my mom took me to UT String Project and it was like, hey, this kid wants to play the violin. And they're like, sorry, kid, we don't have any violins, but we have some cellos. You want to play that? And I said, oh, okay, that's fine. So I played this like really small cello that sounded like death. But, you know.
Well, I think we all benefited from that because you're an amazing artist. And you're also a clinical psychologist. I believe you're practicing as well, right?
Yeah.
And I was curious, what's the connection between the music and your practice of psychology? How does one influence the other?
Yeah. Short answer is emotion. Emotion. And collaboration, for sure.
Are you able to tap into you compose your own pieces often, mm-hmm. right? Are you able to tap into something there that you think that other composers might not be able to because you kind of understand the way the mind works?
No, I think for me, I don't really know how other composers approach, but I know how my mind works and from my own, doing my own psychotherapy and from training. And I know when something resonates and I know that it's okay to go there and to explore it. And that's both in my body and in my felt, my emotions. And that's where I draw both my inspiration musically as a composer. And that's where I tune into in sessions with people.
Do you ever use your cello in the sessions?
No.
It'd be very soothing, I think. It's so beautiful. Now that we're in pandemic and you can't really perform live, how are you finding an outlet for your desire to perform and to connect with people through your music?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Well, in the beginning of the pandemic, I did a lot of like virtual performances, both as a practice for myself and getting over my own performance anxiety. I would do like my own sort of busking Instagram, IG live sessions. And then also people there were just lots of virtual shows happening. So I would do a lot of those. Now, as that's died down for this month, I have embarked on another recording project. And so it's been being in the studio in a safe way with other musicians working on my full length album. So
what does a safe way look like? I mean, and how is that different?
Yeah. Isolation booths, Grace. And wearing masks. And when we're not in studio session, we're outside in the fresh air.
It must be lovely to connect with your fellow musicians.
Oh, it's so nice. Yeah. It actually, to me, I felt these last four recording sessions I did had a really special release for people involved. Yeah.
And when can we look forward to your next album?
I'm hoping to release it in like October, November. I'm hoping. Yeah. It's called Margaret in the Wild.
Oh, I love it. You could do a little Taylor Swift, just drop it on us without any notice there. I'm so also curious about your alias, Bailu. Where is that from and what does it refer to?
Yeah, Bailu is the name I gave my cello. And so I perform under actually two, I perform under my own name, Mia Pixley. And then I perform under Bailu as well. And Bailu's the name of my cello. And I made that name up. And I liked the sound. I thought it sounded mysterious. I thought it sounded a little Southern. I don't know a lot about my origins in terms of like where I came from. And so I really identify with sort of the way things feel as a source of like real in some ways. And so Bailu has that like mystery Southern rootedness. I created it out of my own mind, and it's soothing to me. The sound is soothing. Bailu, it sounds nice. So that's the name of my cello, and that's the name of my project.
Well, do you talk to your cello? Is your cello alive to you in that way?
Totally. Yeah. We got a relationship.
I would think so. I mean, I find that people who are artists, especially who hold their instrument, it does become a piece of them, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I embrace her. Like, we are intimate. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, that's so wonderful. Well, and you also perform and collaborate with your husband, is that right?
I do, yeah.
And how has that been?
It's good. Sometimes it's not good, but it certainly has. We did our first collaboration the first year of our son's birth. I mean, like after our son was born, and that was a good outlet for us. We just worked through a lot of parenting stuff. We tried to practice making time for each other's artistic practices in pursuit of creating this project, which is called Sparse Suite, a call and response music and visual art project.
Well, we look forward to hearing more of your work, and we're just grateful that you were able to join us tonight, Mia. You can find more about Mia on her website, miapixley.com. And as we go out, let's hear another piece from Mia as Bailu is performing Eleonora. Thanks so much, Mia.
Thank you, Grace.
And that's City Visions for this evening. Our guests tonight were Dr. Laura Morgan Roberts, professor of practice at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business, and Precious Stroud, founder of the Black Female Project. We also had Bay Area artist and clinical psychologist Mia Pixley. Earlier this hour, we heard from Aaron Alday, health reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle, and Dr. Peter Chin Hong, professor of medicine and an infectious disease specialist at UCSF. Thanks to all for joining me this evening. For a link to this and other City Visions shows, visit the City Visions page on KALW.org. Our engineer this evening was Damian Miner, and tonight's show was produced by Chris Nooney and Wendy Holcomb. Join us again next Monday at 6 p.m. when we'll look at racial health disparities. Good night, and thanks for listening. Stay safe. Sweet boys, Eleonora died young, Eleonora. Curse me, Eleonora, I won't leave. Our valley of the many colored grass. Tick, 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 thank you.
before she slipped away her spirit. She promised me an